and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Novels, movies, music, comic books, video games, stand-up comedy, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. This is episode 9, and you can find the show notes at ump.fm. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is a writer and podcaster who founded and hosted shows covering comics, writing, video games, and more. He's also a novelist and webcomic author, and even did a stint as a journalist for Comic Book Resources. But he's best known as the co-founder and co-host of one of the very first dedicated comics podcasts, in the form of Secret Identity, a show that continues to this day, which is probably some kind of record, and is where I first came to know him almost a decade ago. He is, of course, Mr. Brian Letendry. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, and I was just flabbergasted to realize that it has been almost 10 years.
Yes, it has.
Since we met each other. That is, that blows me away.
It is kind of crazy, isn't it, to think, yeah.
It is absolutely crazy, and it's so funny because every time we talk about the origins of the podcast for Secret Identity, you are one of the first people that I talk about because I feel like you were one of the first comic writers to go out and use podcasters as a grassroots PR movement and really connect with that community, which at the time was just so new. And so for us, you were our first big guest on the show. And I remember actually sending you questions via email and you recorded the answers to them. And that was, I believe, the first interview that we ever had.
That's right.
In the podcast was you responding via audio to the questions that I had emailed you. And I was so excited at the time. And yeah, almost 10 years ago now. We will hit 10 years in March of 2016.
That is awesome. Congratulations. And yeah, wow, I'd forgotten about that. Yes, I recorded separate MP3 files for each answer, didn't I? And mailed them to you.
How far we have come since that time.
Yeah, yeah, old school. Okay, so moving on to this week. So what I wanted to say was you've chosen a format that hasn't been covered on the program yet, which I'm very happy about because I'm trying to keep this as diverse as possible. So tell us what you've chosen and give us some context around its release, when it was released, the reaction to it upon release, why people generally malign it, why you think that's incorrect, and your thoughts in general.
This is like the podcast that I've been waiting to do for years now. I'm so excited because you and I also talk a lot about music outside of the comic book stuff and things like that. And you're a musician yourself, and so you're obviously a huge music fan. I am a diehard 80s heavy metal fan. I grew up in the 80s. I was in high school from 1988 to 1992, and that was an exciting time for heavy metal in America. And so what I'm going to talk about today is I'm going to talk about one of the, what's considered to be the big four bands of thrash metal in the United States, which are Megadeth, Anthrax, Slayer, and Metallica. Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk about Megadeth and specifically their 1999 release called Risk, because it was a real departure for that band at that time. And it's an album that I've come to appreciate much more now, especially hearing their latest album that came out in 2013. I think it's a great time to go back and revisit Risk. But Megadeth is my favorite metal band of all time. And one of the things that I love about them is that I'm a big fan of the underdog and sort of which is why I think Megadeth is a perfect topic to talk about on Unjustly Maligned, because I feel like Megadeth is a band that has never gotten the credit that they deserve because they are always in the shadow of Metallica. For those that don't know the history of Megadeth and the history of Metallica, most people are familiar with Metallica. They're the biggest band in the world.
Yeah, you've probably heard of them. Yeah,
right, exactly. And of course, Metallica founded in the early 80s. Their first album, Kill 'Em All, is considered to be one of the greatest metal albums of all time. In fact, their first four albums, I would say, Kill 'Em All, Ride the Lightning, Master of Puppets, and Justice for All, probably considered to be the best four Metallica albums, and those first three are considered to be pretty much masterpieces. Well, Dave Mustaine was a guitar player and a member of Metallica before Megadeth even existed. And before before Metallica's first album came out, Dave Mustaine was fired. And when he was fired from Metallica, he went on and formed his own band, Megadeth, in 1983. Now, at that point in time, Metallica was just starting to get humongous. They released, I believe, Kill 'Em All in 1983, in May of 1983. So that's when they really exploded. Although they had demo tapes that were out, I remember kids in my high school had cassettes of the demo tape, and it was called, I believe, pardon my French, it was called Metal Up Your Ass, was the first demo tape that Metallica put out.
That's right. That's actually what they wanted to call the first album, but the record company just wouldn't go for it.
Exactly. As you might imagine, not as marketable as Kill 'Em All, although Kill 'Em All, not the most friendly title in the world itself. So Dave Mustaine sort of, he wasn't the first guitar player that ever played in Metallica, but he's considered to be a founding member of Metallica. Got kicked out, and the rest is sort of history. So he goes on to form Megadeth. They put out their debut album in 1985, and that is Killing Is My Business and Business Is Good. They are considered to be one of the big four, like I mentioned before, who are Anthrax, Slayer, Metallica, and Megadeth. Now, Anthrax had put out their first album, Fistful of Metal, in January 1984, and Slayer had put out Show No Mercy in December of 1983. So it was Metallica, then Slayer, then Anthrax, and then Megadeth sort of rounded out the first albums from what went on to be considered the big four of American thrash metal. Mm-hmm. And I love all four of those bands, I should say. So I'm a huge fan of all four of those bands. Probably Metallica the least, but that has a lot to do with what happened with Megadeth. Because as I said, I am a fan of the unjustly maligned, and I am a fan of the underdog. And in my mind, Dave Mustaine was certainly that, in the way that he was sort of kicked out of Metallica and then essentially built Megadeth to sort of get back at them. That was, you know, when he first formed Megadeth, it was all about revenge. It was about him being able to show that he could create a band that was going to play music that was superior to what Metallica was putting out, and that he didn't need them, that he could go and sort of do his own thing, and he was going to, you know, create a band that was really huge. Now, of course, Metallica has sold over 110 million records worldwide, and Megadeth has sold about 50 million records worldwide. So if you're comparing millions and millions of sales, Megadeth will never be as big as Metallica. And I think at this point, Dave Mustaine has probably made peace with that, but Megadeth has certainly gone on to become a very well-regarded band, and certainly in the tapestry of American heavy metal, absolutely one of the forefathers, again, considered to be one of the big four. So they've made it. However, they'll never be as big as Metallica.
And if he hasn't made his peace with that by now, I'm sure he probably never will. And it's, I didn't actually realize they'd sold that many. So 50 million, that's not too shabby, you know?
Well, and they have a lot of platinum records in their history. And really what's interesting, especially as we sort of look at their discography, is that the thing that sort of set Megadeth apart, and the thing that I've always loved about them, is, well, first of all, I'm a nerd. And of those four bands, in my mind, Megadeth is the nerdiest of the four. What, there was a poster that I used to have hanging up in my room when I was a kid, and Megadeth was known as their tagline, especially for the first few albums. They were called the world's state-of-the-art speed metal band. And I would say that when you look at Slayer and Megadeth and Anthrax, all of those bands are heavy. What Megadeth had that those bands didn't have to the same degree was a level of complexity. Megadeth has always been a band that employs the very technically skilled musicians, and the way that their songs are structured and they write their riffs are to a level of complexity that is not usually found in Metallica and Anthrax and Slayer. And that's not anything against those bands. Those are very different styles. But to me, Megadeth were a group of scientists in my mind, when in terms of how they created their metal.
So you mean nerdy in a musical sense?
Absolutely.
Right. Because I was going to say, surely, I mean, Anthrax, in terms of sort of what's traditionally thought of as nerds, you've got to go for with Anthrax. Scott Ian has written Lobo comics for DC, for heaven's sake, you know.
And Scott Ian is awesome, and Anthrax is great. The reason I love Anthrax is because they're East Coast, you know, and I grew up on the East Coast.
Yeah.
And so they're the New York entry, whereas all the other bands,
they're all West Coast, aren't they? Yeah.
Are California boys. Yeah. But the Megadeth's approach to songwriting to me and Dave Mustaine's approach to songwriting was just technically on a level that the other bands were not operating on. And so, and I would get very nerdy about the way their solos sounded and you know, just the way that they got the sound out of the guitars for particular albums and things like that. And if you're into sonics and you're into, and you get nerdy about music, there's so much great stuff for you to dig into in Megadeth's back catalog. Even going back to the original Killing Is My Business and Business Is Good, it starts off with a classical piano piece. And some of the intros and some of the riffs and the way that they layer them in that album is just light years ahead of what you were hearing from the other bands at that time. And again, I loved those other bands, but Megadeth to me just scratched an itch that no one else did. It was like the thinking fans metal. And so, and that's really what I loved about them. And again, I had that big poster in my room, the world's state of the art speed metal band. It was basically like, that was their thing. Dave Mustaine and company were playing music that other people just couldn't play. And that was sort of what made them stand up. You know, Slayer maybe could get the tag that they were the most aggressive of the four bands. Anthrax was like the fun band. They were the guys that, you know, with the Not Man and you know, and stuff like that. They seemed to be having the most fun.
Songs about Judge Dredd. Yeah,
exactly. Oh, amazing. Right. And Stephen King and things like that. And so that, like, the thing that I listened to Anthrax for was for all those references, because they were referencing the things that I was growing up with. They were referencing, you know, The Stand and Misery and all that kind of stuff. And Judge Dredd comics, like you mentioned. Megadeth was angry and technical. And that's what I really liked about them. Like, they were focused like a laser beam, and you could hear that in even their earliest, most underproduced, raw albums. And those early albums were made for, I think the Killing Is My Business was made for like $8,000 or something like that. And half the time they were blowing their money on drugs, and so the money that they had to make the albums didn't all go towards the album to begin with. And those first few albums were very rough in terms of production. So Far So Good So What, which was their third album, probably was the one that they spent most of their money on drugs before they got the album out. But in any case, so they're toiling away doing that. Meanwhile, you have Metallica that has built their reputation Kill 'Em All, on Ride the Lightning, which is one of the greatest metal albums of all time. And you have you know, Master Puppets, which again is an absolute masterpiece. But the thing about that was, there were two factors in Metallica that I believe were major contributing factors to not only their popularity, but their sound at that time. One was Cliff Burton, who of course passed away in a bus accident, but he was their bass player. And the other was Dave Mustaine, who wrote many of their more popular songs on their first few albums. You know, he wrote Call of Cthulhu. I had a list of them and I don't have it up in front of me, but he, you know, the Four Horsemen and things like that. And so he had a very big effect on their early style, as did Cliff Burton. And when those two influences were no longer in the band, you started to see Metallica's sound change. You started to see it on Injustice for All, because Cliff Burton was no longer there, even though he had written some stuff that went on to Injustice for All. But pretty much after that, you saw them veer in a completely different direction.
I'm not sure you can read too much into Justice, though, because that was, you know, there was so much going on there. You'd got the death of Cliff, Jason coming in to replace him. This was a band in grief, in mourning, literally in mourning. So I'm not a big fan of Injustice for All. It's probably my least favorite Metallica album. But I kind of give it a pass because I'm like, yeah, you probably weren't thinking straight when you made that album, you know?
And I actually love Injustice for All. And I in my mind, it's the last great Metallica album. However, when you listen to that album, if you go back and listen to it now, it is one of the flattest sounding albums that you will ever hear.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons for that is because they, in the making of that album, Lars, in particular, had them turn basically make the bass disappear.
Oh, yeah.
So that the drums
yeah.
and the guitar were what stood up above everything else. And there's actually a great podcast that Eddie Trunk does who is a guy over here that hosts that metal show on VH1 Classic, and he has done metal interviews for years, and he interviewed Bob Rock, who was obviously a guy who worked very closely with Metallica, and they talk a lot about, you know, Sonics and how he gets certain sounds from the albums and stuff like that. And so if you go and listen to that and you know, read into the engineering of those albums, you'll see that what ended up happening with Metallica is that it's a bus that's driven by two people now, and really one person, Lars mainly, but also James. And their creative influence over that band has driven that band forward, sometimes to the detriment of the band, because they don't allow other voices to sort of be part of that. If you've ever seen Some Kind of Monster, then you know, you're very familiar with that dynamic. And it was funny because until that movie, I didn't like Kirk Hammett, because Kirk Hammett was the guy that replaced Dave Mustaine in Metallica. And I wasn't a fan of him. And watching that movie, I realized just what he has had to put up with over all of these years, and had a completely newfound respect for Kirk Hammett, and really have gone back and listened to a lot more of his stuff. But that's a whole, that whole dynamic.
You're touching on a lot of things that I've got in my notes here, actually, about that sort of, those sorts of dynamics. I wasn't going to sort of get into this until we actually started talking about the album itself, but you know, whatever, let's go for it.
Well, because it, and I'm going to bring it full circle here, because now understanding that ability that like Lars has to get to exert influence over other people kind of dials all the way back to this album Risk. So you've got Mustaine, who leaves Metallica and he forms his own band, and he's going to show them. And certainly he did that, maybe not sales-wise, but certainly musically. You have Killing Is My Business, amazing debut album. If anyone has not listened to that, seriously, go back. You've got Gar Samuelson playing drums for them, who was sort of a jazz drummer when he came to Megadeth, and they're doing things musically that those other bands aren't doing. Then you've got P-Cells, But Who's Buying? Obviously, very well-known album with really the emergence of Vic Rattlehead as their iconic mascot at that point in time. You see the great red cover with him, you know, hanging over the for sale sign there. P-Cells, amazing song. The Conjuring, amazing song off that album. Wake Up Dead, amazing song off that album. Just that one really, I think, put them on the map. Then they followed up with So Far, So Good, So What, which was, again, an album that was really, the production was clouded by just a lot of drug use and a lot of problems, and sort of wasting money on things that were not the making of the album, but still a great album came out of that. You had In My Darkest Hour, which is a song that they're very well known for now. They did a cover of Anarchy in the UK, obviously very punk influenced. So, you know, that was Dave sort of throwing that on there to show some of their influence. But it was 1990s Rust in Peace that cemented Megadeth as, at that point in time, maybe the best of the big four musically, and certainly a band that will never be forgotten. Rust in Peace is considered to this day, whether you're a fan of thrash metal or not, to be one of the greatest metal albums that was ever created, and it featured what is known as the primary lineup of Megadeth, which is, of course, Dave Mustaine playing lead guitar and vocals. You have Dave Ellefson on bass, who is sort of the other guy that you can't think of Megadeth without thinking about. Nick Menza on drums, who had replaced Chuck Baylor, who had played on So Far, So Good, So What. And then, of course, Marty Friedman, who was in Cacophony and also was a well-known solo artist at the time, who was an amazing, amazing technical guitar player, but also just plays with so much emotion and so much soul. His, what he added to Megadeth at that point in time was really what they had been missing. And basically Dave Mustaine and Marty Friedman together, when you think of guys like Glenn Tipton and KK Downing, when you think of great guitar duos in metal bands throughout history, that is one of the greatest guitar duos in history. And Rust in Peace is just an absolute masterpiece of technicality, of just pounding metal, of amazing riffs, just from front to back, absolutely outstanding record, and never gets old. I mean, I have listened to that record for, I've probably listened to that record 1,000 times without a shadow of a doubt, and it never gets old. I listened to it this week, getting ready for this show. I listened to all the entire catalog of Megadeth again, and it's still just as good as the day that it came out. And so that was huge. That was the one that really got the world's notice when that came out. And then, of course, Countdown to Extinction, and that was a platinum selling album. And then Countdown to Extinction in 1992 was a little bit more melodic and a little bit more diverse, but still really heavy and really technical and just an amazingly well put together album. So those two albums, people hold up Rust in Peace and Countdown to Extinction as really the two pinnacle Megadeth albums that at their height of popularity. And I remember I actually have sitting in front of me my ticket to the Clash of the Titans tour from 1991. On my 17th birthday, I went to a place called Lake Compounds in Connecticut and saw them play. And it was Anthrax, Slayer, Megadeth, and Alice in Chains. And Alice in Chains had just released Man in the Box at that point in time, but they were not well known and they were not well liked among the thrash crowd.
Yeah, they weren't yet the dirt Alice in Chains. Yeah,
exactly. And so, but it just so happened at the time, Megadeth was making their best albums ever at that point in time. But following Countdown to Extinction, you started to see that sort of desire to get more mainstream acceptance start to creep into the music and creep into the band's image and things like that. And so, you know, Countdown to Extinction, I think, really was something that got so much critical acclaim, and not just from the metal community. And so I think there was a part of, you know, Mustaine and company, and definitely at this point, the record companies are saying, hey, we could be getting a lot more airplay. And so now you move into Euthanasia, which was an album that had a little bit slower tempo and I wouldn't say radio-friendly songs, and it was still very heavy and still featured some amazing solos and some great guitar work, but it was, the direction was starting to turn a little bit. And that was like 1994. And so then you go from Euthanasia into Cryptic Writings, which had the lead single off of Cryptic Writings was Trust. Which was, a much more radio-friendly song. In fact, I first heard it playing on mainstream radio when that album came out. But they had songs like Almost Honest, Secret Place. I mean, there were songs on that album that were not super heavy. But then they had a song like She-Wolf, which is one that they still play in concert to these days. That's very fast and sort of very aggressive. But it was sort of all building up to this 1999 album Risk. And so Risk was when pretty much most of what had come before got pushed aside for an album that was really aimed at mainstream acceptance. And it was a bridge too far for most Megadeth fans. So, you know, now that we're a half an hour into the show, I can say that this unjustly maligned album is the album that most Megadeth fans until recently would point at and say that is their worst album. Almost universally, mm-hmm. It is considered by Megadeth fans and many metal fans in general just to not be a good album. And it was such a departure from what people had known Megadeth to be. I mean, here we are in 1999. We're only 9 years away. We're less than a decade away from one of the greatest metal albums of all time in Rust in Peace. And now they've put out an album that, if you took Megadeth's name on it, you wouldn't even know it was them.
Well, and when I was reading up about this, I saw that these days, Dave Mustaine actually looks back and says that he kind of wishes that he hadn't. He kind of wishes that it hadn't been released under the Megadeth name, because he thinks that it would have sold better if it had been under a different band's name, you know, or just his own name.
Yeah, he absolutely does.
I'm not convinced that that's actually true, but I understand the sentiment.
I agree. Exactly. My sentiment's exactly. I don't agree that it would have sold great. I think it would have been more accepted by the hard rock, because I don't even know that I would call it a heavy metal album, but I think it would be more accepted by the music community had it not had the Megadeth name on it. But I don't think it was going to be a blockbuster either way. So that comes out in August of 1999. And the way that it comes out, and this was a bad sign of things to come, is there was a movie being released at that point in time that was called Universal Soldier: The Return. The Jean-Claude Van Damme series, but this one was notable because it was featuring a guy by the name of Goldberg, who was a wrestler for WCW. And the track that Megadeth wrote that was included on the soundtrack for this Universal Soldier movie was an anthem called Crush 'Em. And that is widely regarded to be the worst Megadeth song of all time. It's a song that Mustaine clearly wrote because he wanted an anthem that could be played in sporting arenas. And to this day, you'll still hear it at some hockey games and things like that.
So in that sense, he succeeded.
He did succeed in that, yes. Although I'm sure he cringes a little bit when he hears it now, because again, if you're going to have a song associated with, it's like those bands that are one-hit wonders that have like the song they like the least that ends up becoming their number one hit, and then they just have to live with that for the rest of their lives. And,
right,
and this is sort of one of those things where, and this album went gold, by the way. So it did sell. It didn't sell anywhere near as much as most of their other albums, but it did. It debuted at number 16 on the Billboard 200, I think, on the Megadeth name alone, and it was certified gold at the time. However, Crush 'Em is a terrible song, and it was a terrible song to lead with because it essentially soured everyone on this album before it even came out. People were like, what is this? I don't even know what to make of this. It's just this very cheesy anthem-y song, and he's grunting and groaning during it. It's really just bad. And I've always thought about Megadeth too, is that not only are they very punk influenced, but they're also influenced by guys like Alice Cooper. And so there's always been sort of a little bit of a theatricality from Megadeth in their music. And when you listen to the first one, Killing Is My Business, you can definitely, it's so heavy on atmosphere. Like, it feels like an album that you want to listen to around Halloween, and you've get that in bits and pieces over the years, but.
And their stage shows as well. I mean, Megadeth, of one of the sort of, you know, few things that I remember learning about Megadeth myself in the sort of 80s and early 90s was that Megadeth was the one metal band who used to choreograph their headbanging while they were playing live. So they would literally plan things out like, okay, during this bridge, we'll both step forward and headbang for like 8 bars. Then we'll step back and the bassist will step forward and headbang for 4 bars. And then we'll move into the middle eight, which is like, just blows my mind. Like, what?
The other thing too about Dave Mustaine is he's very conscious of the image, especially in later years, that the band puts out. I remember guys who have joined the band have had to get their teeth done. Guys have had to learn to, you know, play differently when they come into the band and stuff like that. He's very conscious of what image that the band is sort of putting out there, especially again in the later years of the band. I think it was Al Petrelli who used to play. He plays for Trans-Siberian Orchestra and has played for a bunch of other bands as well. Who I think he was the one who had to get braces or something when he came into Megadeth. I'd have to look back and read it, but I remember reading a story about that. So Dave's a peculiar guy for sure, but when he goes wrong with the theatricality stuff, it really comes across as very cheesy. And that's one of the problems with Risk, is that there's a lot of things to this album that while maybe felt like they would appeal to the mainstream at the time, really came across as very heavy-handed and sort of cheesy. And when your name is Megadeth, you know, which I believe the original definition of a Megadeth was the death of a million people by a nuclear weapon or something.
That's
like
correct,
that, which is one of the things that appealed to Mustaine wanting to call the band, you know, Megadeth. And you're considered to be one of the big four of thrash metal. Cheesy is not necessarily, you know, a concept that you want to have associated with your band. And that's part of the problem that Risk has, is that it comes across as very cheesy at times. However, there are a lot of really good songs on this album, and you just have to dig for them.
Wow, there's so much here that I disagree with. I was never a Megadeth fan. Of the big four, they are my least favorite by far. My list always went Metallica, stroke Anthrax, depending on the album, then Slayer, and then a very, very big drop-off to get to Megadeth. And one of the reasons that I didn't like Megadeth so much, it turns out, is exactly one of the reasons you do like them, which is this obsession with complexity and technicality at the cost, in my opinion, of songs. And this is the thing, for all his faults, that Lars and James have in Metallica, is they may not be technically as great players as people like Mustaine or drummers like Dave Lombardi or whoever, but they write really good emotional metal songs, and they may not be complex, they may not be technical, but they are just great songs. And I think maybe that is because they are more emotional rather than Megadeth. Yeah, always felt thin and cold and kind of reedy. And I mean, I'm a huge nerd. I don't have a problem with sort of nerdy muso stuff. I love Jean-Michel Jarre, for heaven's sake. It doesn't get much more musically nerdy than that. But when I come to heavy metal, And maybe this is because I grew up listening to things like Black Sabbath and Motorhead, courtesy of my father. But when I listen to metal, I want percussive. I want really heavy drums. I want very loud guitars. And I want aggression, like you were saying about Slayer. I really want that aggression. I don't particularly want great complexity. I can appreciate a very complex heavy metal guitar solo, but it doesn't do an awful lot for me. My favorite solos tend to be the ones that are much more expressive and emotional. One of my favorite guitar solos, actually not even in metal, but in rock, is Incubus, the Marillion song, which has a wonderful guitar solo as a coda towards the end of the song. And it's not technically difficult at all. I can play it, for heaven's sake, and I'm a terrible guitar player, but it's emotionally very, very powerful. And so that's that emotional level is always what appealed to me more about metal. And maybe I'm only just sort of having this realization now, but maybe that's one of the reasons why Megadeth just didn't appeal to me. And no, I hadn't heard this album before. I didn't. I listened to it and I was like, well, this just sounds like every other Megadeth album.
Which makes me sad.
Right, exactly. To you, that's heresy. But yeah, I was just like, well, this just sounds like Megadeth. It's like, okay, maybe it's not as fast as the earlier thrash stuff, but other than that, it sounds pretty much the same. Because you can't hear anything except Mustaine's guitar and his voice drowning everything else out in the mix, which is, you know, par for the course. I don't have a problem with Dave Mustaine as a person, but as a musician, the Dave Mustaine band has never appealed to me. And I wonder if that's actually because of this self-conscious attitude that you said, like being very protective of the image. And, you know, you say that he was deliberately trying to appeal to the mainstream with this album, but I always got that impression. And for no reason, this is just purely through the music, but I always got that impression with the thrash albums that he was, you said earlier that they were like, it was like a revenge band to prove that he was better than Metallica. And that kind of comes through in the music and makes it unappealing to me because it feels too, it always felt too self-conscious. And the choreographed headbanging, that's why I remember it. That's the perfect example of that. You know, heavy metal should not be a genre where you are coordinating your headbanging, you know, not to me anyway. It should be more visceral and more emotional than that, to my mind, which is why I love bands like Motorhead and Black Sabbath. And I mean, I do love Metallica, but also Testament, who are a very visceral gut level band, and the John Bush era Anthrax. I actually don't like the Joey Belladonna era of Anthrax. I thought they were pretty awful, but the John Bush era, which ironically is the era that most Anthrax fans don't like, I think was wonderful because it was really heavy and emotional and visceral and just really kind of, you know, gut punching. Pantera, one of my favorite heavy metal bands of all time. Again, very kind of emotional and percussive. I keep coming back to this word percussive, but I really do think that drums are a bigger part of heavy metal, of good heavy metal, than a lot of people realize. And that was always one of my problems with Megadeth, was that I could barely hear the drums, and when I could hear them, they weren't doing anything interesting.
There's so many things there that I want to talk about too. And so, first of all, I will say that. So they do prioritize different things, and I do like their approach to songwriting and what I listened to Megadeth for is something that is not really to be found on this album, Risk. Because Risk isn't, so we just talked about, you know, I love Megadeth for their complexity. I love Megadeth for their soloing. I love their approach to riffs. I love that sort of technical, but also I felt up to that point anyways, that especially with Rust in Peace, the Marty Friedman era of Megadeth, when you talk about emotional players, I think that Marty is a very emotional player. And I think he was the missing ingredient for Megadeth. So when you look at Rust in Peace and Countdown to Extinction and even Euthanasia, there's a level of soul to those songs that maybe the earlier songs that were just angry and more technical weren't achieving until Marty Friedman came to that band. And I think they've struggled to recapture since. And there's a great contrast between, if you look at Rust in Peace and then you look at 2010, I believe, was an album called Endgame that came out. And they had a guy by the name of Chris Broderick, who just recently left the band, playing for them, who played for Jagdpanzer. I think it was Jagdpanzer, and he played for a band called Nevermore. You can go on YouTube and you can do a Google search for Chris Broderick, and you will see this guy playing classical pieces to just an amazingly mind-shattering level. Like, this guy is just a technical wizard. However, I felt that his playing lacked the soul of Marty Friedman's playing.
Huh.
And so Endgame, this 2010 album, was probably Megadeth's best album since those 1990s glory days. It was a return to form. It was sort of like Rust in Peace too. It was heavy. It was technical. That was the Head Crusher video that I sent you. The end of that song ends in just some amazing work by Chris Broderick there. And so technically it was just amazing, but it will never be Rust in Peace because Marty Friedman plays with a level of emotion that Chris Broderick is not playing with, or that's not coming across in his playing. So
if more, I mean, it's 22 years too late, but if more of their stuff sounded like this, then I might have listened to them.
Sure.
You know, it's still not great, but it's a lot closer to the kind of stuff that I consider to be good heavy metal. Funnily enough, because you told me about this album, you didn't really give me any background myself, which is fine. But then I went away and listened to it. And in my notes, I've just noticed that I have a note saying, was this an experimental album for them?
It absolutely was an experimental album for them. And it was the last album to feature Marty Friedman, which is a real bummer. Because he wanted to go in a different direction musically too than those very harder earlier albums. He has a very diverse style. If you listen to any Marty Friedman solo albums, he just released a new one called Inferno, which is a bit of a real return to metal, but he's done a lot of stuff sort of in between. And he's an amazing guitar player and plays with a ton of soul and really is worth checking out. Dragon's Kiss is one of his albums, Music for Speeding, and then this new one, Inferno, that just came out. And he's got a couple of videos up on YouTube as well. So it was sad that this was his last album with them, because this is really the worst of the bunch here.
I do understand liking a band's sound, but also liking an album where they experiment. This is the point that I wanted to get onto, because you said that it's strange how you've just said how you love everything about how Megadeth sound, but then you also like this album, which is considered to be, doesn't sound like them. But I do understand that, because one of the things that I, like all of my favorite bands, are bands that have evolved, that do progress, evolve, try out new things. And as a result, haha, most of them have at least one unjustly maligned album in their repertoire. Host from Paradise Lost, Renewal by Creator, 34.788% Complete by My Dying Bride. Even Load. I really like Load. I think Load is a really good album. But, you know, most Metallica fans at the time thought it was dreck. What I found ironic was that 10 years later, I was working on Metal Hammer, and I actually saw a readers' poll where younger readers voted in, and they voted Load as the best Metallica album ever. I nearly fell over.
I know, right? Because a lot of these bands hit that point where they went in a different direction and then almost embarked on a second career that has its own ebbs and flows.
And its own fan base.
Absolutely. And that certainly was the case with Megadeth, because this album really, in terms of their old fan base, was kind of rock bottom. And it began a 10-year sort of climb back to, again, this came out in 1999, and I just mentioned 2010's Endgame, right? Which was considered to be, you know, something that harkened back to the days of Rust in Peace. And so it took them this arc of 10 years to get back to what their original fan base would consider to be an amazing Megadeth record. Now, they had good records in between, but it was something where once they had this sound, it took them a long way to find their way back. Metallica is going through a similar thing right now. This was that point for Megadeth. Risk was the album where they had had some a couple of radio hits coming off. So they have this metal masterpiece in Rust in Peace. Countdown to Extinction, they received lots of critical acclaim for, because it was politically a charged album, but also people thought the lyrics were smart. They got a Grammy nomination out of it. They got, you know, they got some radio play out of it. Then they go into you know, Euthanasia, and then with Cryptic Writing. So we're getting more and more radio play, and now we're at the point where this is an album that seems designed to be acceptable to mainstream metal fans. However, it comes across as an album that is more like a hard rock album in a lot of ways, and features some songs that are really derivative. And, you know, Crush 'Em, again, like I said, really bad to lead with. It's the fourth song in the album, but it's the single that comes out and gives everybody a bad taste in their mouth.
To be fair, let's not forget that this is also the same period when Metallica and Limp Bizkit both did Mission Impossible theme songs, and they were pretty awful as well.
That is true. But when you are the juggernaut that is Metallica, you can, these things don't derail you. They just they're just sort of bumps on the road,
just a blip.
Yeah, for Megadeth this was kind of a derailment at the time. And so song number 8 on this album of Risk is called Wanderlust, and it sounds like almost like a demo version of the Bon Jovi song Wanted Dead or Alive. Like, it's just very derivative of the intro, the guitar line. It's just very, very derivative. And so you're listening to a Megadeth album, which, again, technicality, amazing solos, great riffs, and you're thinking that this sounds like a Bon Jovi B-side. And so that, and nothing against Bon Jovi, because their early albums were great too.
Right, but Horses for Courses, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, you've got those, but then buried in there, you've got songs like, and again, depending on which version you listen to, like Insomnia's, I think, is an interesting song. When you listen to the original one versus the 2004 remaster, they're very different sounding songs, because, and I'll talk about the remaster in a few minutes, but I liked, they're using a drum machine on that song. They've got, violins on that song. And so they're mixing in all these different elements, and it gives it a very sort of frantic, like, it's about a guy who can't sleep. And so, you know, the song feels very sort of on edge. I thought that was an interesting song. If they're going to take risks, I don't mind a risk like that. Prince of Darkness, very sinister song. You've got this sort of pick sliding in the background as the song's building with the bass line in the beginning. It's sort of spoken word lyrics, and then he repeats them within the refrain. So it's very straight ahead, but it's a song that's, to me, very listenable. Then you've got Crush 'Em. Breadline's an interesting song. In a lot of ways, I felt like they were trying to go back to the well of... they had a song called Foreclosure of a Dream that was on the Countdown to Extinction album that got a lot of radio play, but it was an album that was... It was a song that was both melodic and heavy, and they sort of missed the heavy here. And so, again, it just comes off as a very generic sort of rock song. Number 6, The Doctor is Calling. Maybe one of my favorite songs on the album. Again, very sinister. You know, Megadeth like to explore these issues of madness and sort of, you know, again, like a lot of the metal bands that we grew up listening to. But yeah, that's where I like when they sort of sink their teeth into that kind of stuff. And this one has a very sort of disturbed, you know, feel to it. I really like that. I'll Be There is a very mainstream rock song, but it's kind of catchy. You know, again, I can't believe I'm saying that about a Megadeth song, but and then Ecstasy, which is song 9, which comes after that Bon Jovi B-side Wanderlust, I thought was a pretty good song too. The Seven Deadly Sins song, not that great. And then the last two songs on the album are, it's a two-part, it's called Time the Beginning and Time the End. It kind of wavers between being sort of a filler song. I don't know why it was broken up into two pieces, but it's got some interesting riffs in it.
Funnily enough, of all the tracks on the album, those two are the ones that I specifically called it. I mean, I made notes on a few of them, but it was just basically, meh, sounds the same. but Time the Beginning and Time the End, I was like, if you're going to call two tracks, if you're going to be that guy, and you're going to have tracks called Time the Beginning and Time the End, then at least have the decency to do something a bit epic. You know, these are quite short tracks. Give us a 15-minute opus. Helloween would have made an entire album out of that.
Right. Well, and they have made several. Yeah.
Yeah, not two short tracks to finish the end of the album. It was just like, I was actually looking forward to them as I saw them, the album moving towards those tracks. I thought, oh, okay, well, at least we'll get something. Maybe it's an instrumental. Maybe it's something, yeah, a bit epic and pretentious. But no, no.
And the biggest problem with those two songs is that the first part, Time the Beginning, starts off much more interesting. You know, you've got the acoustic, you've got the string instruments playing in the background, and it's this guy sort of looking back at his life and bemoaning, you know, that time has caught up with them and all of that kind of stuff.
The days I saved, I couldn't spend, they fell like sand through the hourglass.
And then when it shifts into a heavier tone, it's just not an interesting one. And so they don't capitalize on what I felt like they built with the first part of that. You know, it's again, all together, it's a little over 5 minutes between the two tracks, but the first part, I think, was more interesting. It just didn't lead into something that was very interesting.
And yeah, 5 minutes for two tracks, when you're going to give them titles that pretentious, that's just, you can't do that.
Right. And so, you know, looking back at the album, I can see maybe five songs out of the 12 that I think are keepers and seven that are just kind of, like you said, they kind of sound like a lot of other stuff out there. And to me, that's the crime if you are talking about Megadeth, is that you're not supposed to sound like everything else that's out there.
I think the bigger crime, it's not necessarily that they sound like everything else out there, because, you know, Megadeth is instantly identifiable, mainly because of Mustaine's voice, but also, you know, often the guitar work and the production. I think the problem is that it sounds too much like other Megadeth stuff. One of my notes on this album is that it sounds like, to me, like stuff that Mustaine could write in his sleep. And that's a problem. You know, when you get to the stage, I mean, fine, on your second album, whatever. But when you get to your 10th album or something, and you're writing songs that sound like your songs, that everybody goes, oh yeah, that sounds like one of yours, that's worrying. Or I think that a band should be worried, a songwriter should be worried if they have that reaction. That's one of the reasons that REM changed their sound so dramatically around the time of Green and then Out of Time, was because they looked back and they realized they started writing a new album, and they realized they were just writing Driver 8 over and over and over again,
right?
Because they could write it in their sleep.
Yeah, and that's the sad thing, is I think that Mustaine would look back at this album and say, you know, this is such a departure for us. It's not like everything else that we've done. It was us sort of trying to go out in a different direction. And I think that is where the album falls short, because if you're going to depart, then depart all the way.
Yes.
And that's really the problem, is that and ironically, one of the rumors about the title of this album is that it was Lars Ulrich who essentially challenged Dave Mustaine to take more risks with his music. And that was one of the things that led to this album being called Risk. So it all goes back to Lars, in that, again, he's sort of always in the shadow of what's been happening with Metallica and maybe putting credence into what's coming out of Lars's mouth or whatever. And so here we have this album where he, you know, reaches out to the mainstream and tries to create an album that is going to get, you know, more radio play and more things like that. And when you listen to interviews and look back and read a lot of stuff about it, the issue of the record company's interference always comes up. I mean, but at the same time, Dave's sort of responsible for what happens with the band. So whether this was something that was driven entirely by his, you know, decision making or not, this is what they came out with. And the thing is, it just sort of landed in the middle. And again, for Megadeth, that's not where you want to be. You don't want to be in the middle.
This is like my criteria for cover versions. The way I judge a cover version is it literally better than the original? Or have you made it sound so much like one of your own songs that it's almost unrecognizable as the original? If you can do either of those two things, I'm probably going to like it. That's a good cover version to me. Because if you don't do one of those two things, what's the point?
Right.
Why are you bothering to cover a song if you're not going to do either something just literally better, or just make it sound like one of your own songs? So,
right.
Yeah, like you say, don't land in the middle.
And that's really where the problem of this lies. Now, having said all of that, and being a Megadeth fan, this is an album that I still go back and listen to. And in 2004, which was about 5 years after this album came out, Dave Mustaine had actually sustained a couple of years earlier a pretty bad hand injury that was like a nerve injury where he didn't know if he was going to be able to play guitar again.
Oh, wow.
And so there was a time where Megadeth had sort of broken up and the future looked bleak. And then he started sort of building his strength back and getting back to playing and stuff. But one of the projects that he sort of took on was looking at all of the Megadeth albums and remastering them. And so he went back to the masters. He sort of remastered all of the albums. And it's kind of one of those things. I'm not a huge fan of remasters of older albums because a lot of times you tend to do as much harm as good. And you're coming to it with a different mindset at that point in time than when you made the album. And a lot of times it just ends up not feeling like what you come out with is true to where the album was coming from. But the interesting kind of stuff that they did with this one was that in some ways it was remastered to be a little bit heavier. So some of the intros of the songs don't have the same buildup. Like Insomnia, the first song, doesn't have near the buildup that it has on the original album. It just sort of cuts right into it. It starts with a violin line and then cuts right into the metal. So it just sort of jumps more out at you. Some of these other songs were, you know, the guitars are brought a little bit more forward and things like that, which again,
Kel Surprise.
Yeah. You know, and I think it was his way of trying to go back and maybe please the fans a little bit more and try to say, okay, well, give me another crack at this album and I think I can come out with something that you guys will find a little bit more listenable.
Then you just come out looking weak.
And the problem is, I appreciate the original version better because the original version, even though the songs themselves were not great Megadeth songs, as I mentioned, I find the album to be very listenable and well produced. You know, it has a decent sound to it. And so going in and kind of trying to make it sound heavier in certain spots, like I don't think that worked out really well for the remaster of it. Other people might disagree. I'm sure there's fans of Megadeth who find the remaster to be a superior version of the album. For me, it just sort of took something away and it didn't add anything.
Yeah.
But it is still an album that I go back and listen to. And I've been listening to a lot more recently because they released an album in 2013 called Super Collider. And in my mind, that is the worst Megadeth album that has ever come out.
You sent me a link to the song Super Collider. Sounds like AC/DC.
But a bad version of AC/DC.
Well, I'm not a big AC/DC fan, so that to me is indictment enough.
Yeah, I got to tell you, it was one of those albums that when it came out, and again, there's probably four or five songs on that album, Super Collider, that I can pull out and say, yep, I enjoy these songs. But overall, a very sort of mainstream rock album, not what you expect from Megadeth, especially because they had clawed their way all the way back to
respectability again. Yeah.
Yeah. They were writing metal again and they were writing blistering metal again. And they were there, you know, the solos were there and everything else, and the whole package was there. And then they went over here. And that was very scary because it made me go back and say, wait a second. First of all, I hope that we're not in the middle of another 10-year arc to try and get back, because I don't think they have that many albums left in them.
Right.
But also, it made me go back and listen to Risk and realize that Risk is a better album than I think a lot of people give it credit for. It's not a great Megadeth album and maybe shouldn't have been released as a Megadeth album. Maybe it should have been released as a Dave Mustaine side project. He had done a project called MD45, which was a pretty interesting side project that he did years ago as well. And it wasn't a Megadeth album, and it could be accepted for what it was. And I think that was sort of the problem here. But this album is a better album than what Super Collider was. Super Collider is so vanilla in almost everything that it's doing that it feels beneath Megadeth. And that's really where my sort of threshold is in listening to a Megadeth album. Is this an album that's worthy of their name and worthy of their level of musicianship? You know, you don't want Rush to come out with an album that just seems to not even be a challenge for them.
Right,
you know,
right.
And to me, like, that, not that I'm saying that Megadeth is on the level of Rush, but for me, that's how I always sort of thought of them, is that they're a band that's extremely skilled, and I expect to hear that skill when I listen to one of their albums. And so to have them come out and play an album where the solos are almost non-existent and the riffs are very vanilla, and you could have any band that kind of could have written this music, is just really disappointing. And that kind of jarred me to look back at this. And these songs on this album, even though it's very middle of the road for Megadeth, are much more interesting than what's happening on Super Collider. So if you haven't listened to Super Collider, I cannot recommend it. you could certainly, if you just want to sort of see, you know, where they might have misstepped again.
But you would recommend that people go back and listen to Risk.
I would recommend that they go back and listen to Risk. You could find it anywhere. I mean, you can certainly you can get it at any of the places where hopefully you're purchasing your music to listen to. You can find plenty of used copies at your local record shop for sure. Although the original one is a little bit more hard to come by now, and I would suggest to go back and listen to the original one, and you know, because it is the album as it originally came out. But if this is your only exposure to Megadeth, let me direct you to their earlier catalog. I would say start with Killing Is My Business and go right up through Countdown to Extinction, and you will hear the progression of a band that just continues to get more and more skilled and then hits on their golden lineup and really puts out a couple of just gems of metal albums. But Megadeth is fascinating to me, as are all the big four bands and sort of where they're, you know, where their arcs have gone. In this Megadeth album, I think, is just reviled amongst Megadeth fans as just a complete sellout and really, really bad. And I don't think it's that bad. I think it's just disappointing because Megadeth is better than this. But again, very listenable and definitely worth revisiting if you listen to Super Collider and we're like, what the heck is this thing?
All right. I think that's where we're going to draw this to a close. This has been very interesting. Thank you, Brian. Yes, I think I will have to get you back on to talk about another album of some kind, or maybe even reverse the roles. Maybe I'll send you, like, you know, a reviled Motorhead album or something, and we can go back and forth.
Well, I'm a big Motorhead fan. We should do a Metallica one. We really should.
Well, the obvious one is Load, because when it came out, it was so reviled. But I love Load. I think Load's a really good album, again, with great songs. That's the thing, you know, it's the songwriting more than the technical playing or whatever. It's always been about that for me. But anyway, so that's for the future. For now, let us bring this to an end. Brian, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
They can find me. The easiest place to find me is on Twitter, at C. Brian Wright. And then the comic book podcast that you mentioned earlier is the Secret Identity Podcast. You can find it at secretidentitypodcast.com. And I have a blog where you can find all of my writing at, which is called cbrianwright.com.
Excellent. Brian Letendry, thank you very much. You've been listening to Unjustly Maligned, Episode 9, with Anthony Johnston and Brian Letendry. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. If you're enjoying the show, please do consider taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes. It really helps. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Wow. That was
We just scratched the surface.
I know.
Because once you start getting into Metallica, it really is, but it's, it, you could
do a whole series. I know.
The big four. I mean, just so amazing. When you mentioned, we didn't even get to talk about what you said about Anthrax, but I wholeheartedly agree with you. Now, I am a fan of the Belladonna years, but I love John Bush and I love Armored Saint.
Yep.
And,
I'm not a fan of Armored Saint, but I loved John Bush combined with Scott Ian and Charlie Benante. I just thought was a power trio that was absolutely awesome.
Well, to me, Charlie is probably the most underrated drummer of all time. Love that guy. His drumming on We've Come For You All is just on another level.
You know he wrote all the music, not just the drums. He wrote all the music for Stomp 442. Mm-hmm. It's incredible.
He's unbelievable.
That's my favorite album of the Bush era. And when you look at the credits, all the music by Charlie Benante, you're like, hang on a minute, that's the drummer. At that time, also better, frankly. You know, for that time, during that time period when Dirt came out,
yes,
that was probably the best metal album of that year.
I can't argue with that. That was an amazing album. And
I love the fact that most people don't even think of Alice in Chains as a metal band because they got tagged with grunge. It's like Soundgarden. Everybody says, oh, they're a grunge band. No, they're a heavy metal band. They're
right.
They're so obviously a heavy metal band.
The only band that really hasn't changed is Slayer.
That's true. But that's kind Slayer of is, Slayer like Motorhead. You don't want them to change.
That's exactly right. And my favorite moment, one of my favorite concert moments of all time, is I saw Anthrax and Motorhead at that same place that I just saw the Slayer show a few weeks ago. Wow. And Lemmy came up and said, "We are Motorhead and we're here to clean your clock." And then they just played straight for 2 hours or an hour and a half, whatever they played. No breaks in between songs, just punch you in the face. Crazy metal. Like, it was so awesome. I've seen them a couple times. I saw them with Megadeth too on IJGantour. Yeah, I saw Motorhead.
I love Motorhead so much. I love Lemmy so much. Have you seen the Lemmy documentary?
I have not seen the Lemmy documentary.
Oh, you must. You must.
I will track that down because
honestly, there's not a lot in it that you don't already know, but it means that you get to sit and watch Lemmy be Lemmy for 90 minutes.
I mean, you just talk about a guy that's just metal. I mean, he is.
To his bones. Yeah, absolutely.
To his bones.
Frankly, I am going to have to edit so much. I'm going to have to edit so much.
Well, you can do a 2004 remaster just like Dave Mustaine did and come back.